Our guest today is going to talk to us about the troubling truth about guilty pleasure TV in these reality shows. Should be a wonderful hour with our guest, Jennifer Posner. But before we go to our guest and talk about her new book, let's go to Media Minute.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Oscar will have plenty to be grouchy about if bills in Congress become law. Three bills are circulating that could cut or even entirely eliminate federal funding for public broadcasting. That's right, it may be bye-bye Big Bird if some lawmakers get their way. NPR and PBS could be on the chopping block, as well as hundreds of other stations that make up the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Conservatives have long tried to slash support for public media, but their ideas are finding a more receptive audience under the guise of NPR's firing of news analyst Juan Williams and the need to balance the federal budget. Congressman Doug Lamburn, a Republican from Colorado, who introduced one of the bills, said public media can, quote, stand on its own feet. In response to the attacks, public stations across the country have started a campaign called 170 Million Americans to remind people of the benefits of public media. Jeff Nelson, Managing Director for Public Strategies from Minnesota Public Radio, reflects on the potential cuts.
To be brutally honest, losing federal funding for public broadcasting would be catastrophic.
In 2010, the U.S. spent $400 million on public media, or about $1.30 per person. In comparison, the British government spent $86 per capita. Nelson said that even with a small budget, our public media system offers programming and local news that commercial media ignore.
Public broadcasting is a crucial source of programming that really is responsive to citizens, not to advertisers. And what that means is that we can go more in depth when it comes to news coverage. It means that we can play bands that nobody else is playing.
Public media receive a majority of their budgets from donations from their audience and grants. But Nelson said support from the government provides the basis for private funding.
We've created a very robust public broadcasting system with very, very little federal money. So if we take that federal money away, you're pulling apart the sweater.
What is it about a 78-year-old widow that Fox News commentator Glenn Beck finds so terrifying? The object of the shock jock's irrational fear du jour is Frances Fox Piven, a distinguished professor and scholar of grassroots activism at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, who has spent her life writing about the poor and unemployed. For the past year, Beck has attacked Piven and her late husband, Richard Cloward.
Cloward and Piven, because you got to collapse the industrialized civilization.
Why is Beck so obsessed? Largely because of an article Piven and Cloward wrote 45 years ago. The article, published in The Nation, proposed that people on the left help poor people in the cities get their full benefits from welfare. Spurned on by Beck's sustained haranguing, his followers have posted death threats against Piven on his website, and he made no effort to remove them until recently, since he's come under scrutiny for these bizarre attacks. Piven was surprised to hear herself described as a violent revolutionary who wants to bankrupt the country's economic system. On a recent episode of Democracy Now!, Piven sloughed off Beck's calling her a commie revolutionary.
I think I'm a Democrat. I think that all of my work has been devoted to remedying the flaws, the distortions in American democracy.
The Center for Constitutional Rights, worried for Piven's safety, called upon Fox News to stop Beck from spewing false accusations against the professor. The network responded by saying that Beck specifically denounces violence and honestly portrays Piven's work. Eric Bollert of Media Matters for America disagrees. He says Beck's stock in trade is incendiary demonization, and Beck has taken lots of liberties to demonize Piven and tell a false story, but is savvy enough to stop just short of specifically calling for violence.
He just creates this hysteria. The country is being destroyed right before your eyes. Progressives are robbing our freedoms. They're going to drive the economy into the ground. They're going to take over the government. America is going to be a communist and or socialist country. And his message is do something. Stop these people.
While nobody is calling for censorship of Fox News, Bollert points to a recent survey that shows the channel is the country's least trusted news source, owing in no small part to the efforts of watchdogs who shed light on the deception.
You have to just sort of continue to monitor it, continue to call out the lies, even though it becomes exhausting. I mean, at some point, it happens slowly, but I think there will become a realization, even within the Beltway press, that Fox News is not legitimate and Fox News is not in the news business.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, January 30th, 2011. Our guest today is Jennifer Posner, who is a media critic, journalist, activist, and the founder and executive director of Women in Media and News, known as WMEN, which is a women's media analysis, education, and advocacy organization. She is also the author of a brand new book just published by Seal Press, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, a detailed, deeply entertaining, and provocative, and frankly disturbing look at reality television shows. And for those of you listeners who've never listened to reality TV, I think you'll be especially interested in this show. And those of you who have watched reality TV will probably be interested to hear these keen insights. So Jennifer Posner, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, it was a real pleasure reading your book for the show. And the first thing I've got to ask you, just before we go into the argument and the evidence and everything else, is the subtitle of this book is The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. And I got the impression you watched an awfully lot of reality TV shows to write this book. And, I mean, was this something you'd watched before you wrote the book? Were you a fan of these shows, or do you watch some of them and then you got the idea for the book? Or do you start watch all these shows basically out of your need to do research for this book?
Well, you know, I watched more than 1,000 hours on average. I think that's about the total over the course of about 10 years of these reality shows, not because I was a fan. I'm not a fan of the genre at all, but in the same way as you might go through the NexusLexis news database and read hundreds and hundreds of articles about a particular topic, if you were going to write a media critique about, say, news coverage of war or global economics, you would want to look at the entire landscape and synthesize where the accuracies were, where the biases were, et cetera. That's the kind of methodology I took to reality television.
So this was not a guilty pleasure for you. This was just a job.
This was a job, but this is to say this was pleasure is about as far from pleasure as I don't even know. I'll tell you this. After the book was done, I went on a strict reality TV fast. I needed sort of a brain cleanse, and I didn't watch any reality shows for about 3 months or so. I eventually broke the reality TV fast to dip my toe back in with Sarah Palin's Alaska, because I thought, you know, when I'm not writing about pop culture, I'm writing about news media coverage of, say, female politicians. So this is sort of a way to look at both at the same time. But, yeah, no, I didn't enjoy this. I did it so that others can not have to.
Well, Jennifer Posner, let's talk first of all, and I think we'll probably have some listeners who aren't really very familiar with the genre for whatever reason. And I have to confess that, except for the fact that my youngest daughter for a couple of years was a huge fan of a program called Project Runway, I haven't really watched any of these shows, though I have friends who have. So I know a little bit about it, but I learned a great deal from your book. What is reality TV? What's its history? How prevalent is it today?
Well, reality TV has become increasingly popular over the last 10 years, specifically because it is incredibly cheap to produce. It costs anywhere from 50 to 75% less to make a reality show than a scripted program. And the first major huge reality TV hit happened in 2000 as a test case for the newly merged CBS Viacom and Infinity merger. I'm talking about Survivor on CBS. And with that show and with many others afterward, there's been this attempt by media companies to create the illusion of popular demand. I'm not saying that no one likes reality TV. It's undeniable that millions of people tune in to shows like American Idol, which is a singing competition, or Dancing with the Stars, which is a dancing competition with celebrities. There are some shows in the reality format, the unscripted format, that are wildly popular. But most reality shows don't get those kinds of stellar ratings, but they get to linger on the dial much longer, actually, than scripted programs, sometimes scripted programs with higher ratings, because the scripted programs use union labor, use actors that they have to pay high wages to, use writers in the Writers Guild, generally are much more expensive, where reality shows not only are less expensive to produce, but come with an embedded stream of embedded marketing money, anywhere from hundreds of thousands, sometimes to millions of dollars per episode or per season for advertisers that want to integrate their products and their brands, not only into the scenery, but the dialogue, the plot points, the casting choices, and the story arcs of unscripted TV shows.
And roughly what percentage of primetime programming now is considered reality programming?
You know, it depends on the station and the network. It's become wildly popular in cable in particular. There are some networks like VH1 and MTV that pretty much that's the majority of what they air is reality television.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of network television, it's increased over the years. Fox is, I think, the one that airs the most, but ABC airs quite a bit, NBC airs quite a bit, anywhere from 25 to nearing 50% of the primetime lineup, depending on the network, can be devoted to reality television now.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jennifer Posner, the author of the new book, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, just out with Seal Press. A very pleasurable book to read, although, as we'll find out in this next hour, a very disturbing book to read, too, in many respects. If you'd like to call in with questions or comments for Jen Posner, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Jen, before we go into some of the details and the critique you make, and especially I think there is an extraordinarily powerful message in this book about gender and women and misogyny on these programs that I want to talk about at length. But if we could just start by talking about a few of the representative shows, again, for listeners who might not really be immersed in this reality show culture so they can appreciate what we're talking about. You know, what are you talk about two or three of the big shows that have been especially successful or especially of cultural importance?
If you want to talk about gender, for example, on reality television, there's no longer running franchise than The Bachelor, and
mm-hmm.
It's been off The Bachelorette. The Bachelor is currently on ABC in its, I believe, 16th season. There have been, we're in 21 seasons of the franchise between the 16 Bachelorettes and five or six Bachelors. The premise of The Bachelor is basically that single women are pathetic losers who can never possibly be happy, successful, fulfilled, or basically anything other than miserable, unless they're chosen by a husband. Doesn't matter who the husband is, can be any guy as long as he's wealthy, because for men, we're told in reality TV dating shows, men only need wealth or the illusion of it, given by product placement sponsors, to be Mr. Right. They don't need to be loyal or trustworthy or charming or smart or even nonviolent. And women, we're told, are basically worthless unless they're perfect tens physically and pretty interchangeable, and that they need to be pretty and passive and kind of pathetic in order to be desirable. And that once you have that premise established, then you have about 25 women who show up at a mansion dressed in ball gowns, basically ready to throw down, and they pump in cat hissing sounds because you know you can't have it be too subtle. You have to make sure everybody understands in the audience that women are catty and want to scratch each other's eyes out in order to win male attention. And every episode he eliminates some of them and he makes out with others, and the idea is in the end one girl is going to get her perfect fairy tale love. And, of course, you know, that fairy tale only lasts until the cameras stop running and the Bachelor dumps her after he's contractually no longer obligated to canoodle on the couch at Live with Regis and Kelly. It's, you know, it's a show that basically premises that true love, the equation behind true love is fat wallet plus skinny chick. And it robs us of all of our humanity, I think.
Well, Jen Posner, reality shows, they're unscripted. The meaning they don't, the dialogue is theoretically not being something written for the real live people who are normal, regular people who use their real names, but rather it's their own words in situations they're put into by the producers. But I mean, clearly there's editing going on. I mean, how real is reality TV? I mean, how does that work behind the scenes?
I'm so glad you asked that. That's the main conceit of reality TV, that these are real people acting on their real emotions, and maybe the situations themselves are extreme or unusual and manipulated by producers, but mostly what happens once they're in these situations is some approximation of the truth. And that actually could not be further from the truth. Reality TV is scripted in non-traditional ways, meaning you don't have actors memorizing lines of dialogue, but you do have casting directors who start out looking for people who they think they can easily turn into stock characters. For example, quote-unquote, the bitch, the douchebag guy, the slutty girl, the weepy woman, etc., the gangsta guy if it's a man of color. And then once they have those people who they either, who basically either promise to behave a certain way or who editors believe they can manipulate or edit into those kinds of characters, then the editing comes in where producers will film 100% of the time. They'll use about 1% of what they shoot, and then that 1% is edited to suit master narratives. So, for example, on a show like The Bachelor, as I mentioned before, if the master narrative is that women are pathetic and whiny losers who can never be happy without a man, then any shred of independence or any shred of, say, a woman on the show doesn't actually like the guy who's at the center of the show that season. Maybe she's not interested in The Bachelor. Those kinds of comments would be left on the editing room floor, and in the end, producers can take little bits of dialogue from a Monday and a Wednesday and a Saturday, cobble it together to make it seem like the woman who might have said on a Monday, I don't really like turkey sandwiches, I'd rather have sushi for dinner, and on a Saturday said, I really love going to water parks, I hope they take us there on one of those group outings. And then on a Wednesday, got a call from her mom saying her uncle died, and she starts crying. They could edit that together to make it seem like the woman says, I really love, and then they could cobble in the name of the bachelor, and then they could show a clip of her crying, and it could make it seem like she's irrationally attached to this guy in a crazy way, who she's just met in 2 days ago, even though that's not what she said at all.
How can I ask you, how widespread is that? That seems to me... You know, I don't know if that's Federal Trade Commission actionable material, but it certainly seems a violation of the implicit nature of these programs.
Well, that's the thing, right? It seems like as critical media consumers, that would seem like a massive misleading of the audience. It would also seem like an intentional and perhaps actionable disservice or even slander to a guest. But with reality shows, it's actually just standard. It's just the way it goes. And people who go on these reality shows are most often expected to sign incredibly draconian contracts that in which the contracts will say, we can turn you into a fiction. We can edit your commentary and your behavior in any way we like. You have no recourse. Many of these contracts say if you get injured during the course of the show, you have no recourse. They'll say even at times if you die, your estate has no recourse. I mean, who knows how ironclad the contracts are, but most people who go on these shows are not wealthy. In fact, many, I would guess, are very low income, and certainly shows like America's Next Top Model or American Idol, competition shows that offer either promise to offer or actually offer a big payday at the end if you win, draw many low-income guests who think that if they go on this show, certainly in the case of young women who go on America's Next Top Model, they'll say over and over in clips on the show, this is my one chance, this is my only shot. Winning American Idol will, or winning America's Next Top Model will be the way I'll provide for my children, et cetera, be the way I get out of my podunk town, be the way I get out of my job at Walmart. And so those kinds of contracts that threaten to sue people beyond their wildest dreams, even if they're not ironclad, most people are scared off. And so there are gag rules where they're not allowed to talk about negative things behind the scenes. They're not allowed to say anything that would, quote, damage the franchise. Even, you know, people don't really know what that means, so that very often they just stay quiet. But there's nothing actionable legally because they've signed these contracts, and the producers say, look, it's not real life, it's TV. It's fiction.
Our guest today, you just been listening to, is Jennifer Posner, author of the new book, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, just published by Seal Press. We're talking about reality TV shows. If you've watched them, this is your chance to call in or listen to an expert who's been assessing them now for some time and has this new book out. Or if you're just learning about them for the first time, I think you're going to learn quite a bit about what is being consumed by American people. And I think the audience for a lot of these shows tends to skew younger, doesn't it, Jen Posner?
The audience does tend to skew younger, but it's not at all just a youth genre.
Mm-hmm.
Reality TV has been shown by the Nielsen ratings to be the favorite genre of youth, but it's also shows like American Idol are the number one show of every age group, apparently. So it really depends. But I do want to mention that you asked how prevalent the kind of editing I was talking about is.
Mm-hmm.
It's so prevalent that there's a term for it in the industry. It's called Frankenbite editing, when you can cobble together little bits of conversation to change the meaning. And I know you've mentioned that some of your listeners may not be aware of reality shows, but for those who have watched, they should pay attention the next time they see their favorite reality show and a cast member is saying something, but you don't see that person saying something. It's just in voiceover while the person is physically, you see them doing something else. That's a moment where you should maybe consider that what they're saying was either cobbled in later or changed in some way. It's not a guarantee that it was, but it's a good tip that generally, when you see voiceover, that's the first sort of hint that maybe what you're seeing is attempting to get you to think something else is going on.
Jen Posner, I think that the lion's share of your book, but by no means all of it, but a big part of it deals with a feminist critique of treatment of women, the coverage of issues of gender and sexuality. And it's very disturbing for me, frankly, to read this. And it's truly astonishing, much like Susan Douglas's book, which we had Susan on a few months ago on Enlightened Sexism, about how regressive and, I mean, really the sexual stereotypes used here are throwbacks. I don't even know if they were throwbacks. They're almost throw-ups. I mean, they're throw-outs. I don't know, because I don't remember this sort of stuff being this prevalent or this grotesque when I was a young man, for example. But at any rate, the book goes in some detail, and I'd like to go through some of this because I think it's extraordinary. First of all, the stuff on women's bodies and women's body types, and related to that, issues of anorexia and bulimia. Could you talk about how that relates to reality television shows and how they influence that?
Sure. Take a show like America's Next Top Model, which is one of the earliest of the makeover and beauty shows. This show packages itself as in some way empowering to girls by helping them achieve their dream of being beautiful and being famous for being beautiful. But really what it is the world according to CoverGirl Cosmetics, which embeds itself into the dialogue, the scenery, and the challenges on that show. It's the world according to the fashion and beauty industry, which used to have to wedge its regressive ideology about gender and about women's bodies and about women's worth into static print ads and 30-second TV commercials. The ideas that we've always seen about women in fashion and beauty ads have been extremely damaging. You know, the promulgation of violent images, the glamorization of violence, the idea that women are worthless if they're not extremely skinny and very white and very Western and very young and very passive. Those have always been, as we've seen from Jean Kilborn's work over the years, as we've seen from Robin Anderson and Anne Elizabeth Moore's work over the years, media critics and advertising critics have shown that you know, the more advertising women see, the worse they feel about themselves, about their bodies, et cetera. And that's always been the case, even with static ads, but with reality television, with a show like, for example, America's Next Top Model, fashion and beauty advertisers now have an hour at a time for 13 episodes a season, season after season, through which they can market their ideology to us as if it is simply reality, as if it's simply our stories. And that's what that's why reality TV is so dangerous. So a show like Top Model, which is a competition in which girls are regularly judged for being too fat and too skinny, too tall and too short, too aggressive and not aggressive enough, for not being, you know, classically beautiful enough, and classically beautiful is often defined in all of those problematic ways, also gives us other ideologies within that show. For example, there have been numerous episodes on Top Model over the years where girls have been expected to pose inside coffins and get lowered into open graves because it's so sexy and glamorous and fashion-forward to have women posed as dead things. There is even a homicide victim challenge that I wrote about years before the book came out, where the girls were made to pose as basically brutalized corpses. They were shoved off of roofs, and they were stabbed in the chest, and blood everywhere, and shot in the head, and all the while, judges were saying things like, "You look beautiful dead, and gorgeous," and, "Oh, I'm sorry, can you change your arm position? We need you to look like you were brutally murdered, not just like you're sleeping." You know, when we see these kinds of images packaged to us as just story, not as advertising, we're really opening ourselves up to massive propaganda.
You know, and we're going to get to the phone lines in a second. We have callers waiting patiently, but I want to follow up on this point. We're going to get to it again later, I'm sure. But this whole issue of body types and thinness, which you talk about in the book or write about, to me, this, and then with related to that, anorexia and bulimia. And I was struck when I read your book, Jen Posner, how these programs really play on this and push this meme about women being unhealthily thin is the only sort of appropriate or sexy way to be.
Yeah, and it's actually, that's absolutely right. And it's actually even more dangerous than that, because it's not only that these shows, whether it's shows that are explicitly about beauty, like a show like Top Model, or like the plastic surgery shows like Extreme Makeover and The Swan and Bridal Plasty, which is exactly what you imagine it sounds like. But it's also shows like The Bachelor and Flavor of Love and all the dating and marriage shows that are also about beauty. It's also shows like American Idol, which is supposed to be, and Dancing with the Stars, which are supposed to be about talent competitions. But when the women are involved, those shows become beauty contests as well. The definition of beauty in these shows is always so extremely thin as to be extremely unhealthy, but the explicit text of these shows, whether it's judges telling young women who are who have body mass indexes that would be basically equivalent to a mark of starvation under guidelines from the World Health Organization, that they are, you know, excellent and gorgeous and doing everything they need to do, and telling girls that are actually normal, healthy, average young women who are also very pretty that they're not treating their bodies like a temple and they're letting themselves go and they're unhealthy. These shows not only reinforce the cripplingly small, impossible to achieve range of beauty images and beauty ideals that have always plagued women in entertainment media, but they also now go one step further by saying that is healthy, that starving yourself, or at least looking as if you do, is healthy, and that if you actually have what most normal people would consider a healthy relationship with food, then and if you have even, you know, half an ounce of fat anywhere on your body, then somehow you're unhealthy. It's extremely twisted and extremely problematic.
Our guest today, Jen Posner, author of Reality Bites Back, the Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV. This is live. If you want to join us here on Media Matters at WILL AM 580, the phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers who have been waiting very patiently. Let's get to them right now. Let's start with line 4, LaSalle County. You're on the air with Jen Posner.
Afternoon. I was down in Australia and New Zealand about 13 years ago, and am I right in that reality TV started down there? They had a program on that was a competition athletic kind of thing called Who Dares Wins. And then it sort of jumped across the ocean over here. That's my first question. Did it indeed start there and jump across the ocean after that?
Well, why don't you give both questions, then we'll give Jen a chance to answer everything.
My other question is that there's this dark aspect to a lot of these reality shows. There's a particular show that I find abhorrent is Jersey Shore, where they take these young Italian-American kids and they basically pump them with alcohol and watch them fight and cheat on each other and, you know, sexually exploit the girls or what, you know. Those are my two questions. If you've seen and comment on the dark aspects of, the appealing to people's prurient interest to see other people suffer.
Yeah, thank you very much, caller. And I can tell you, having read the book, that this is a big theme of Jen Posner's book, Reality Bites Back. So, Jen, the first question, I guess, is where did this all start? And then you heard the second question, Jersey Shore and humiliating people.
There were quite a number of reality shows before we saw them. Here in 2000 or so, there were quite a number in Britain that then got morphed and transferred over to here. But it really kind of blew up here. In fact, the very first reality show was on MTV in the 80s. It was called The Real World. But at the time, it was just sort of a one-off show. It was influential, but it wasn't the genre that we understand it to be today. The genre changed in a major way when U.S. television, a lot of it goes back to media consolidation and cable market fragmentation. So in 2000 or so, in 1996, we had the Telecom Act of 96, and media mergers continued apace, and at the same time, cable markets were branching out, and advertisers were trying to figure out ways to get viewers to see their products in ways that they couldn't just fast forward through the commercials with as much oomph for their dollar as when they just had, say, three or four or five stations to choose from, as they had in decades earlier. Once reality TV became this sort of possibility for advertisers to embed their products into shows so that it didn't matter if people tried to fast-forward through commercials because they wouldn't be able to fast-forward through the show itself. They'd see the commercial the entire time. That was a super, super important factor in the proliferation of these shows at the same time as advertisers were seeking to capture markets that they didn't know how to capture anymore with so many different channels on the air at the same time. It really kind of became – the turning point was the year 2000 between – a show called Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire, which did originate here on Fox. It was greenlit by a guy named Mike Darnell, who I devote a lot of scrutiny to in the book. He was the executive at Fox who greenlit that show, which was produced by the guy who later went on to produce The Bachelor. The premise was, it was sort of a Miss America meets Mail Order Bride parade, where you had a slew of women competing in a pageant-style competition to marry a stranger on air, and they actually performed a legal wedding between this guy, Rick Rockwell, and a woman named Darva Conger on air, who had never met him before. Later, it turned out that she annulled the marriage very quickly when the smoking gun revealed that not only was the guy not rich, that's not why she annulled it. She annulled it because it turned out that he lacked money, but he made up for that by a restraining order taken out against him by a former girlfriend whose house he had broken into, and he'd roughed her up and threatened to kill her. That is who Fox thought was, you know, qualified to be Prince Charming. So you want to talk? The caller wanted to talk about the dark aspects of reality TV. It started out with dark, right? Especially where women's safety and dignity are concerned. It started out as a genre that never cared even remotely about women, about what's good for them, what they need, even their basic safety. And that show got a huge, huge percentage of the market share that night. And so that kind of kicked everything off. A few months later, Survivor happened, wasn't originally going to be aired. None of the networks really wanted Survivor. So Mark Burnett, the producer, once it wasn't greenlit in the first place, went back to CBS later with a whole ton of advertisers in tow and tried to re-explain it. And he's like, I know you said you didn't really understand what the show was about. It's Gilligan's Island, but they're on a real island. There's real people, and they're eating bugs. And I know you said you didn't get it. You didn't think people would want it. But listen, we can get hundreds of thousands of dollars from advertisers who will give us, for example, a tent from Target with the Target logo right on the tent. And we can have challenges on the island. And whoever wins the challenge can win the tent. And then everybody else will be sweltering in the heat or, you know, shivering in the cold or bitten by, you know, mosquitoes or spiders. And meanwhile, we'll show how great it feels to the winner to be inside this Target tent. And subliminally, Target will be positioned as the brand that is absolutely crucial to viewers' survival.
No, Jen, before
we... All right, sign us up. So that's sort of how the genre got its footing in the U.S. There were some shows in Britain, and I'm sure probably Australia as well, but now we end up exporting tons of reality shows. America's Next Top Model is shown both the American version and also country-specific franchises of Top Model are shown in hundreds of different markets outside of America.
Now, Jen, he asked about Jersey Shore specifically, but this comes through in your book, too, that while these shows, the treatment of women is misogynistic oftentimes and sexist almost at all times, the guys don't especially come across especially well either in these shows. And I think Jersey Shore is Exhibit A.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's one thing that people need to understand about, you know, feminist media critique. Looking at the misogyny that exists in, for example, reality television is not at all to say that men come out really well in the genre either. There are a number of shows that have portrayed men extremely problematically. Jersey Shore, as you say, could be considered Exhibit A. I also think that when we're talking about masculinity in reality TV, it's important to understand that white men are generally shown in a much more positive light than men of color. When you see, but that all men come off in certain shows like Jackasses, to be perfectly honest. That's kind of, you have a show like Tool Academy where the entire premise is a bunch of guys are big, macho, drunk, overgrown frat boys and need the largesse of cable television to rehabilitate them and turn them into, you know, good people. You have a show, but even on that show, where all the guys come off as kind of, you know, overgrown chimps, I guess, you'd have that show would be considered better than, for example, in terms of the way men come off, than a show like From G's to Gents, which is short for From Gangsters to Gentlemen, where men of color are the primary cast members. Mm-hmm. And in that show, the men are generally considered criminals, thieves, thugs, violence, goons, etc. And it's only through some well-meaning cable television franchise that they are going to be educated and rehabilitated into upstanding members of society. Anytime, whether it's a show like Charm School for women or a show like From G's to Gents for men, anytime a reality show promises rehabilitation, run. Because the stated premise is never the actual premise. The actual premise is always these people are awful and they deserve to be laughed at and mocked and, you know, we're giving their idiocy to you on a voyeuristic plate and, you know, point and stare and laugh. That's the underlying premise.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Jennifer Posner, who you've just been listening to, author of the new book, Reality Bites Back, The Troubling Truth About Guilty Pleasure TV, just published by Seal Press. We have a couple callers I'm waiting patiently. We'll get to them right now. But if you want to join us and call in, the number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's get back to the phone lines now to line one, Charleston. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Jen Posner.
Hi. I have to say that this is what Patty Chayefsky predicted back in 1976. I've been in network. I've been appalled by this, particularly by the ethical message that is sent by some of these shows. I remember seeing Survivor when I was first on, and I thought, well, what's being sold here is the idea you should get ahead by deception, manipulation, and betrayal. And I thought, you know, it's like Lord of the Flies, but not as a tragedy, as a comedy. And I just wanted to get your ideas on the ethical message we're sending, particularly to kids, with shows like this.
I think that the ethics of reality TV are extremely damaging, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. Whether it's the idea overarchingly in competition shows that nothing matters other than winning. Take a show like The Apprentice, which is Donald Trump's business competition show, and you should really understand that show to have business competition in air quotes, because nothing that goes on that program would actually be considered acceptable in an average workplace. In fact, much of what goes on that show would be considered legally actionable around sexual harassment or racial harassment.
I shouldn't laugh, but I mean, just the idea that Donald Trump is some sort of figure of business leadership says it all.
I know. I mean, that actually brings me to another point. Everything about this genre is packaged in whatever way the producers want to package it, and whatever we know to be true about American culture or about individual people and ethics, et cetera, is often extra textual. It's outside of the realm of what's going on in this supposed reality that they're beaming to us. So the stated narrative of The Apprentice is Donald Trump is this brilliant business leader, and he's going to help everybody learn to be rich and learn to be successful. And they never mention on The Apprentice that this guy has been, you know, borderline bankrupt a couple of times, and that he's been sued for fraud and all of that. They just, you know, he's rich, so therefore he must be
smart,
a business icon.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have him saying in that show, I remember one of the very first episodes of The Apprentice, he introduces the cast members or the competitors to each other and brings them to his ridiculously gold-encrusted loft in New York, his penthouse suite where everything looks like it's from some, you know, Louis XIV mansion, and just gaudy and gross, but way over the top with the wealth. And he says, you know, if you work really hard, you will live just like this. And that's another screwed up problem in the reality TV universe that is very much in line with what corporations and advertisers want us to believe, this myth that there are no institutional barriers toward wealth, that the only people that are wealthy are people who work really hard, and the people who are poor because they're lazy, and they just don't, or they're stupid. And meanwhile, what it takes in reality TV to supposedly become wealthy is, as the last caller said, anything that you need to do to win. So it doesn't matter that, for example, on The Apprentice, women are portrayed as having no inherent intellectual or professional ability, so they have to rely on their sexuality to win competitions. If it's a sales challenge, they, you know, can flash their breasts or drop their skirts to win, et cetera. And corporations, Fortune 500 corporations, have spent upwards of $2 million a pop to integrate their products, you know, cars and Rolex watches. You know, I don't remember if it's Rolex, cars and jewelry, and I believe a marquee jet company once integrated itself into that show. It doesn't matter that so much of what goes on that program would be considered sexual harassment or would be considered business fraud. It just is, you know, what TV wants us to believe.
But, Jen, before we've got another caller, I want to get to a second, but there's a really important point you make in the book that maybe it was the most disturbing thing you wrote of all. And I want you to comment on, because it follows up on this point, which was that you said you've been talking about reality shows now to audiences for the past decade, on college campuses in particular. And you wrote that early in the decade, you know, 2001 to 2003 or so, students were definitely with you. They understood the problems with reality TV. They saw what all these weaknesses with it, and they were critical toward them. But you say now you go into college campuses in the last couple of years, and students basically, you know, are immersed in them and sort of take them at face value. Is that correct summary of what you said?
Well, sort of. The beginning certainly is. When I first started talking about gender and race in reality TV, and I would love to talk a little more about race and reality TV in the next last amount of time we have together. But when I first started talking about these issues, students tended to be really critical. They hadn't grown up yet with reality shows in the water. And so if I showed them clips from a show like The Bachelor, they would ask me questions like, are they kidding? They think that this is something that women would, why are they trying to tell us that women can't be happy without a man? Why are they trying to portray women as so, as only catty and stupid and always in competition with one another? Why are they trying to tell us that women are pathetic losers, et cetera? And they would be really kind of keyed in to the editing techniques that seemed to them to jump right off the screen. And they'd also get really upset when they saw young girls being manipulated or being insulted by judges on a show like America's Next Top Model, when judges would tell average healthy young girls that they weren't pretty enough, weren't good enough, weren't skinny enough, et cetera, and that they, you know, should do X, Y, and Z to meet some external standard. Students generally would rebel against those concepts and would talk about Tyra Banks as being, who's the host of that show, as being manipulative or nasty, et cetera. Now, I get, it's not that all students take it at face value. More students than ever will say, just like adults, oh, I know reality TV isn't real. But when you dig underneath that, you know, in the next breath, they'll say, oh, yeah, but that jackass needed to be voted off the show. Or, oh, but that girl was such a witch, and et cetera. And if you think that you know anybody, anything about anybody who's been on these shows, if you think you know who's a jackass and who's not, then you don't know it's not real. And they'll say to me, where they used to say, I can't believe Tyra Banks would degrade a beautiful black woman like that by telling her that she had to shave her head or wear a weave and not have her hair natural, et cetera. Now they'll ask me how much weight I think they need to lose if they want to audition to get to be on Top Model.
Now they'll judge
the people on the shows more than the producers and the manipulative plot devices of the shows.
Our guest, Jen Posner, you've just been listening to. We have one caller left I want to get to. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air.
Thanks, and thanks for taking my call. I think this is just a really excellent program. I've never seen a reality show, so I find what you're saying very disturbing, because in general I feel like the way women are portrayed in regular media, there's very few positive images of women anyway. So to hear some of the things that you're talking about in these reality shows is pretty disturbing. I think it does say something larger about our society and where we're going. I was just wondering if you had any insight into why misogyny is still so acceptable with very little protest, especially, you know, kind of with these reality shows. I would think more women would be more critical of this stuff. And like I said earlier, you know, it just seems like people aren't really talking about sexism now. I think there is talk about racism, but in general in society, sexism just isn't something that's on most people's radar screens. I was just wondering if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. Jen Posner?
Well, sure. That's to some degree the answer to that is why I'm a media critic. It's why I focus my work where I do. I don't believe that sexism is a thing of the past. I don't think that most women believe that. I don't think most people are as regressive in their mindsets as, for example, reality TV would pretend we are. But whether it's reality TV or whether it's news media, which underrepresent women as sources and guests in Sunday morning talk shows, which underrepresent women as newsmakers in on front page stories, which underrepresent women as experts in framing the issues of the day, media companies have played out for decades the erasure of women's intellectual contributions to the point where, and also, I'll interrupt myself to say that also not only the erasure of women's contributions, but the invisibility of women's analysis of the problems that are still prevalent where gender is concerned in America. So it's not that, you know, everything, sexism is a thing of the past. It's not even that we don't necessarily understand that there are barriers to fight and ways to get active. It's that media companies have tried to get us to forget that information, have tried to get us to think that, that we should just move on and that everything's perfect now. And we saw a lot of this in the 2008, in coverage of the 2008 election, where media companies were telling us that basically Obama was getting so popular because we were post-racial, and that Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin were basically not, you know, not basically facing any kind of sexism anymore because, look, they're women and they're fighting for the White House, so therefore we must be. This idea on the part of media companies that a couple of individual people being rising to positions of power, whether it's an African-American man or whether it's a couple of powerful white women, that that somehow means that race or gender problems have been banished to the annals of history is a very convenient notion on the part of media, but it's not accurate. So when we get back to the idea of misogyny in reality TV, I hope that the caller understands that it's not that misogyny, the kind of misogyny we see on these shows, whether it's wife swap or bridezillas or any of the plastic surgery shows, it's not that real people think that those things are representative of our day-to-day lives. The media companies are telling us, are showing us stories that they want us to believe are our reality. But as I note in the book, this is an intentional regressive mode of media. At the same time as, for example, when Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin were fighting for the White House, at the same time, Bravo was airing The Millionaire Matchmaker and The Real Housewives of New York City and The Real Housewives of Atlanta with women who only aspired to lives of leisure. At the same time as women were achieving Olympic medals and breaking all sorts of world records in sports, everything from figure skating and tennis and swimming and pole vaulting, et cetera, in 2003, that was the year that UPN debuted America's Next Top Model, telling us that women's bodies were only available to be decorative props. In 2000, when Condoleezza Rice was first named the first African-American national security advisor, that's when we saw Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire on Fox, telling us that women can only achieve success by proxy as arm candy to rich husbands. So the idea is that no matter what women have achieved in our culture, in quote-unquote reality TV, those achievements are invisible. The reason I wrote the book is because reality TV is a genre that has succeeded in doing what the most ardent fundamentalists have never been able to achieve. They have created a world in which women not only have no real choices, they don't even seem to want any real choices. If the only thing people knew about America was what they watched in reality TV, they would think the women's rights movement and the civil rights movement never happened.
Yeah, you mentioned the civil rights movement there, Jen, and you mentioned earlier you'd like to say a few more words about race on reality shows. We've only got a few minutes left, but if you wanted to just throw something in now, that'd be great.
Sure. I'm glad that you asked that. The first few years of reality TV, I would say from 2000 to 2005, race generally was racism came in through tokenism and invisibility, where people of color were rarely involved in casts. When they were, they often ended up eliminated very quickly. When they were tokenized, as, for example, on The Apprentice, you had the stereotype of, quote-unquote, the angry black woman on shows like Top Model. You also had the idea that black women were basically divas, manipulative, et cetera. When you very rarely, if ever, had Asian people involved. If you did, they often were edited to be, quote-unquote, sneaky. If they were women, they were edited to be either passive or hypersexual. And then something changed. The invisibility was replaced with casts on cable television in 2006 on VH1, casts that were predominantly people of color, mostly black and Latino, on shows like Flavor of Love. But those shows ended up, that kind of increased visibility ended up being a curse, not a blessing, because Flavor of Love, a dating show that recast a former symbol of black power in from one of the most popular, most effective hip-hop groups in the 80s, Flavor Flav, recast him as this, you know, basically mockable buffoon, and as the kind of gross, misogynist, pompous jerk from lascivious hip-hop videos with 25 women, you know, grinding on him and hopping too whenever he said jump. So the idea with Flavor of Love is that people of color started showing up more on cable television reality shows, but in very much the same mode as old minstrel shows. I think that reality TV has pretty much modernized the minstrel show for the current media era, and it's extremely damaging and very close to historical modes of understanding who people of color are.
You know, we're down to like the last minute, Jen Posner, and you know, you go at length in the book. We haven't a chance to get to this. You know, people who watch these shows or just learning about them, what can they do? What are the options we have as citizens, as people, to not have our mainstream TV culture inundated with this sort of these sort of values?
Well, the last, since we only have a minute, I can't go into all the details. What I will say is there are two chapters at the end of the book, a chapter on media literacy and a chapter on media justice activism. The last chapter on media activism I opened to leading media activists, media scholars, and independent media producers, all of whom I asked the question, what can an average person do to change the media system? And so we have Andrea Quijada from Media Literacy Project talking about lobbying for K-12 media literacy programs in school. We have we have Jonathan Lawson from Reclaim the Media talking about media policy activism, and on and on. The idea is not that everybody should do everything, but that reality TV doesn't exist in a bubble, and we need to look at the larger structural issues behind the production of this genre.
On that note, Jen Posner, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. So let me take this off.
Go to www.realitybitesbackbook.com for info then.
Okay. Jennifer Posner, our guest today, author of Reality Bites Back. Thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank Kyle Krohauer for working the board, Melissa Trentz, my phenomenal producer. I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back a week from today talking about revolution in the Middle East, I hope. All right. Until then, everyone, have a great week.